Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is December the 16th. We are in Parshas V'Shalach, page 382. And we are up to Pasuk Chav Zayin, verse 27. We discussed last time how the Jews were in the middle of a seesaw of things going well, then things not going well, then things going well, then things not going well, then things going well, etc. So the most recent thing was Mara, where they came and the water was bitter. And now they travel again, and this time they come to a wonderful place. Vayavau Elima, they came to Elim. Visham Shtem Esrei Enos Mayim, and there were 12 wells of water. Vishivim Tmarim, and 70 date trees, palm trees. Vayachan Usham Alamayim, and they encamp there on the water. So why 12 and 70? So what's the number 12 correspond to? The 12 tribes. And 70?
The Sanhedrin.
The elders, the Sanhedrin. That was the 70. So here Hashem gave them a place to encamp where the numbers represented what the Jews were doing correctly, what they were good for. The 12 tribes, the 70 elders, and it was a physical manifestation of the fact that the Jews were doing well. They were following Hashem properly. But the next one, that's a good one. That ends there. We don't know what happened there. We move on to the next travel of the Jews. And we keep going up and down, up and down. As we've mentioned, that there's no growth if it just remains good all the time or just remains bad all the time. There has to be some sort of a change in how things are going. And here it happens again. Vayisume Elim, they traveled from Elim. Vayavau Koladas Bnei Yisrael Midbar Sin, and the entire congregation of the Jewish people came to the desert of Sin, Asher Bein Elim Uvein Sinai, that was between Elim and Sinai. So they left Elim, they were heading towards Sinai, of course that's where they're going to get the Torah, and now they're in Midbar Sin, they're in this wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And when did this happen? On the 15th day of the second month, that would be the 15th day of Iyar, let's say some merit Mitzrayim, from when they left Egypt. So here the date is told to us. The other travels of the Jewish people, we do not know the exact dates of their travels. We know when they crossed the sea. That was 7 days after they left Egypt. But after that, we don't know how long they stayed in each place and how long they traveled for and what the dates were. Here we have a date, the 15th of the month of Iyar. We won't have any more dates until they get to Har Sinai. They're going to get to Har Sinai on the 1st of Sivan. Yeah. So here we have the date it's spelled out to us. The date is interesting in that it says it's the 15th of the second month from when they left Egypt. So the Torah is telling us an important factor over here, that we are now counting months from when they left Egypt. We know that the first mitzvah of the Torah is what? Is HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. That this month is your first month, and that is the month of Nisan. So we already know that the Jewish people, we Jews, count from Nisan as our first month. Instead of Tishrei, which is when Rosh Hashanah is, you would think the first month of the year is the month in which the first day of the year occurs, which is Tishrei. But we Jews, as always, do things in a strange way. The first of the year is in the seventh month. That seems to be contradictory. But that's the way it works, because you know, Rosh Hashanah, the first of the year, is the first of the year for everyone. It's not just for Jewish people. That is the first of the year for all of humanity, all of the universe. Mm-hmm. We Jews have a special month, which is our first month, and that is Nisan. Why? Here the Torah tells us, because it's the month that we left Egypt. That is when we started as a nation, when we leave Egypt. And so when we're counting months, we count the second month from when we left Egypt. From now on, everything is counted from when we left Egypt. That's the significant date. And it's the 15th of the second month, what day of the first month of Nisan, what is the date in which we left Egypt?
15th.
The 15th. So this is exactly 1 month after leaving Egypt. 1 month later, we arrive at the wilderness of Sin, and we're about to have a problem. What's the problem going to be?
Food.
There's going to be no food. And therefore, we're going to have to receive the
man.
This date is recorded because this is the date that we are going to receive the man. We don't receive the man on the 15th. We're going to receive the man on the 16th, on the next day. On the 16th of Iyar, the 16th of the second month of the year, that is when the man begins to fall. We're going to have that whole story spelled out for us over here. What were they eating until this date? Until now?
The matzah.
Okay, so they were eating what they brought out of Egypt. The leftovers that they brought out of Egypt and that they baked after they left Egypt, all of that lasted them for an entire month, which would seem far too long for food to last. You don't need refrigeration for matzah, but how much matzah could they have baked already for so many people? And they're traveling, you would have thought they couldn't possibly have had that much. And it was miraculous that the food lasted this long. But now Hashem allows that food to end. He doesn't miraculously keep it going anymore. The food is gone. And that will cause the Jews to need to ask for food. And of course, how they ask and how Hashem responds is what it's all about. Yes?
Did they not have any livestock?
They did have livestock. They could have eaten some of the livestock. However, livestock does not last for a long period of time. Once you start to slaughter them, if that's all you have to eat, it goes very quickly. And livestock can only last, especially without refrigeration, livestock can only last it does not replenish itself fast enough to eat that exclusively. So you're right, they could have done that, and I guess in a pinch they would have, but they recognize that that's not going to be the solution to the problem. All of humanity is being judged on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is not, it's the one holiday of the year that's not a Jewish holiday. It is a Jewish holiday. We're the ones who observe it. We blow the shofar. But we are, when we know that the entire world is being judged, not just the Jewish people. Whereas the other holidays of the year are for us and us only. I don't mean to say that non-Jews should observe Rosh Hashanah. They shouldn't, because it's not their mitzvah. It's not one of the seven Noahide laws. It's not Rosh Hashanah. But that they should recognize that they're being judged, that would probably be helpful. That they should realize that they're being judged on that day.
When do they have a new year?
Well,
different
cultures. Different cultures have their own, what they consider
right.
New Year. It's incorrect. Really, the first day of Tishrei is when their year renews.
So you're saying they shouldn't observe it? But
they can't observe it the way we do because it's not their mitzvah.
Right.
However, the fact that they're being judged is true. They're being judged just as we're being judged. Now the 15th of Iyar, as we said, is when they run out of matzah. So Hashem deliberately stops the matzah, which was lasting in a miraculous way anyway, in order for the Jews now to react, and they do, but they don't react positively. Pasuk Beis, verse 2, Vayilonu kol adas b'nei Yisrael Moshe v'al Aaron b'midbar. The entire congregation of the Jewish people complained against Moshe and against Aaron in the wilderness. And here the Torah spells out what they said. Vayomru alehem, they said it to them. Vayomru alehem b'nei Yisrael, the b'nei Yisrael said to them, Mi'itein museinu v'yad Hashem b'eretz Mitzrayim. Who would give our deaths in the hands of Hashem in the land of Egypt? Better we should have died in Egypt at the hands of Hashem. B'shivteinu al sir ha-basar, when we sat on the pot of meat, Ba'achleinu lechem lasova, when we ate bread to satiation. Ki yotzeisem osanu el hamidbar hazeh, for you brought us out into this wilderness. Lihamis et kol hakahal hazeh bara'av, to kill this entire congregation in starvation.
Ungrateful comment.
Well, you may call it ungrateful, and it certainly sounds that way, but let's analyze what exactly is being said over here. And let's do that first of all by comparing this complaint to the complaint we had very recently, which was the complaint about water, which was in Pasuk Chavdal, verse 24, where it says, Vayilonu ha'am al Moshe le'mor manishte, and the nation complained against Moshe saying, what shall we drink? That's it. What shall we drink? So, it doesn't say anything about we should have died in Egypt. It doesn't say anything about we had so much to drink in Egypt. They said, what should we drink? Also, the complaint over there is against Moshe. Here it's against Moshe and Aaron. Over there also, the complaint, it just says the nation complained. Here it says the entire congregation of the Jewish people complained. It's clearly a more intense complaint over here. And if we compare it to one other complaint that we've had, which is before they crossed the Red Sea, they complained. Now that complaint, yes, that's back on page 370. Pasuk Yudal, verse 11. Vayomru Moshe, they said to Moshe, Hamibli ein kivorim b'mitzrayim, are there not enough graves in Egypt? L'kachtonu l'mus b'midbar, you took us to die in the wilderness. Mazos asisalonu, what is this you've done to us, l'hotzionu b'mitzrayim, to take us out of Egypt? Halozeh adavar, shedibarnu elecha b'mitzrayim labor, isn't this the thing we spoke to you about in Egypt saying? Chadal mimenu, leave us alone. V'navdah es mitzrayim, let us serve the Egyptians. It's better for us to serve the Egyptians from our deaths in the wilderness. So that was the complaint back then. Now, Hashem takes into account the circumstances in which the complaints were said. They may seem quite harsh, but remember that the first complaint, which is the one before the Red Sea, was said before Hashem had saved them completely from the Egyptians. It's true that Hashem had struck the Egyptians with plagues. It's true that Hashem took the Jews out, but the Egyptians were still a very powerful army, a very powerful fighting force, much more powerful than the Jewish people were. Had Hashem not saved the Jews at the Red Sea, the Egyptians would have absolutely slaughtered the Jewish people and taken back the survivors as slaves. The Egyptians still had much more power than the Jews did. And so the complaint, although it seems harsh, but it's in the context of, I don't get it. Why'd you do this to us? You could have left us in Egypt for the same price. Why'd you bring us out in order to get us slaughtered? What's the point? So that first complaint, although it is said harshly, and it's not the greatest thing, but one can excuse it to a certain extent. They had not yet really been saved. They'd been taken out, but they had not yet really been saved. Then comes the Red Sea, and the greatest miracles yet occur. Incredible miracles, saving the Jewish people, destroying the Egyptians, where the Jews see measure for measure each Egyptian punished according to what they did to each Jew. Each Jew was able to point and see, that was my tormentor. He whipped me and hit me over the head, and he got smashed over the head. You were able to see every little thing and see exactly what the person got back because of what they did to him. So they're saved. Now there's an expectation that the Jews have a little bit more emunah, a little bit more faith in Hashem, that he will take care of them. Then we have the incident with the water. Now the incident with the water, the complaint is not as intense. They complain and say, what shall we drink? It's a fair thing to say. What shall we drink? I mean, look, Hashem, you took us out. You're providing us with our needs. We trusted in you and followed into the wilderness without worrying about our provisions. Okay, so now what? It's been 3 days. There's no water. What shall we drink? Now, they didn't say it nicely. They didn't come b'hachna with humility and say, I know we don't deserve anything, but the children are thirsty. What do we give them? Like, they didn't come with that kind of humility. They said, what should we drink? But nevertheless, the complaint is still a valid complaint. It's not like the complaint has no basis, has no place. They do need what to drink.
Yeah, they can't go on.
They can't go on without drink. I mean, it's a valid thing to say. And it's not as detailed, just, what should we drink? Here, there's no food. Now, it is a valid thing to complain about not having food. If I come to your house and you're my host and I have nothing to eat with me, I have nothing to drink with me. So, and you say you're going to take care of me, I don't need to worry about it. Or better yet, if you are, if I'm going on survival training in some way out, and you're my guide, I know nothing about surviving in the wilderness, and you're the person. You tell me, you say to me, listen, trust me, come with me, and I'll take care of you. I'll show you what kind of plants are edible and what you can. I'll tell you everything. We get out there in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing to eat. And you don't show me what to do. Well, obviously I'm going to complain. What am I supposed to do? It's a valid complaint. You're supposed to be taking care of me, and you're not showing me what am I going to be able to, eat. So it is a valid complaint. Just like what am I going to drink is a valid complaint. It's valid. The problem over here is not the fact that there was what to complain about. There was. But there were two problems with the complaint. One is the intensity in which it was done, invoking Egypt and making Egypt seem like some bed of roses. Well, we had this pots of meat and the bread, right? So there's that. And in addition, unlike water, where they didn't have it for 3 days and then they complained, how long did they not have food for over here? It just got used up. It just got used up. So now it's the first thing. This is right away. They said, there's no food to eat. What are we going to do? And there's a very intense complaint. It's hard to be judgmental. We're not there. And in our pampered lifestyle, you can be sure that we would have a hard time with this as well. Probably a much harder time than they did. But what would be, from an objective standpoint, what would have been the correct thing to do? Again, without being judgmental in that sense, that we could have done a better job, but at least to understand if we are ever, God forbid, in such a situation, what is the proper thing to do? The proper thing to do is to say, listen, Moshe, Aaron, listen, there's no food, it ran out. What does Hashem expect of us right now? Are we supposed to go foraging? Like how do we handle the situation? But the Jews reacted in a much more intense way.
Didn't Moshe see that they were running out of food?
Mm-hmm. So as we're about to see, Hashem did this on purpose. He wanted the Jews to run out of food, and now he's going to bring them the mud. And the mud is going to be the ultimate test, as we'll see. But the fact is that even before the mud falls, the Jews' way of complaining is not pleasant. It's not in a nice manner. It is worthwhile noting that Hashem still does not, he doesn't take exception. He doesn't punish. He doesn't do. He accepts the fact that the Jewish people still are relatively green. They just got out of Egypt. The fact is, they don't have food. And more than that, they haven't seen me give them food yet. You see, just as being safe from the Egyptians, it was a new experience. They needed to be safe from the Egyptians. I never saved them from the Egyptians yet. So they complained. They needed water. I never gave them water. They complained. Now they need food. I never gave them food. They complained. These complaints, when it's the first time in that type of experience, again, there is something excusable about it. But if, after complaining about water, Hashem gives them water, then the next time there's no water, you would expect a softer type of complaint. Because they would have had experience already with Hashem giving them water when there was no water. And similarly with food. Hashem gave them food when there was no food. Hashem saved them from certain deaths at the hands of the Egyptians. So the first time around, there's something understandable about it that a person can say, like, you know, what do you want from them? They never saw Hashem do it. It's not that they necessarily doubted Hashem's ability, but they may have doubted that Hashem would do it for them. Here, will he actually do it for us? But once he does it, then the second time around, that's not as excusable. So we will find, once we get to the second round of complaints of these sorts of things, Hashem isn't so kind anymore. He still saves the Jewish people. He still provides all of our needs. But he still holds against us some of these complaints, as we will see as we move along. Not having food is a terrifying thing for people. We live, Baruch Hashem, in a very affluent time, whether we personally have a lot of money or not, but we live in an affluent time. We don't just live in an affluent time in terms of the way that we live, the conveniences that we have, but we also live in a country and in a time where food is plentiful. Food is not just plentiful, it's literally all over the place. The amount of food that is thrown away by Americans is far more than any country, any people has ever thrown away in the history of mankind. It's unbelievable how much food is thrown away by people, by individuals in their own homes, and then also by institutions, by commercial establishments and things of that nature. There is so much abundance of food that it becomes worth a lot less, because there's always more where that came from. We, Baruch Hashem, therefore, don't really appreciate what it means to not have food. We may appreciate what it means to not have so much money and not be able to buy as much food as we would like. That we may feel. And we may feel a pinch sometimes. And also, we may not be able to eat as much as we would like to, either for personal reasons or because there isn't as much food as we would like. And we do fast several times a year, so we know what it is to be hungry. It's not like we don't know what it is to be hungry. We've done that. But it's far different to be hungry when you know where your next meal is coming from than to be hungry when you don't know where your next meal is coming from. It's terrifying to be hungry and not to know where is the next meal coming from. It's a very debilitating and terrifying feeling. And we, Baruch Hashem, don't understand it. We haven't felt it. But it is something that for a lot of history of man, and also for other people in the world today, is a very real feeling. And it's a very terrifying thing. The Gemara says, Igra d'tanisa, the main reward for fasting is tzidkasa, is giving tzedakah. That's the main reward. Rashi explains, why is giving tzedakah so crucial to a fast day? So Rashi says, because the poor people, when they fast, don't have food to break their fast with. They don't have food to eat when the fast is over. And therefore, the main thing to do when one is fasting is to provide food for after the fast for the poor people. So one can argue, one can ask, I mean, okay, I understand that giving tzedakah is important, but only on a fast day? They don't have anything to eat any day of the year. Well, what's the fast day all about? But because when one is really hungry and not knowing where the food is going to come from is very scary and debilitating. To fast is hard, but when we all know that when the fast is over, we're going to eat, and where the food is going to be, and how much food there's going to be, we're going to be able to eat until we're satiated, it's a lot easier to fast. I always tell people, and we do this in my family, Bli Neder, we try to remember to do it every fast day, that before we eat, to break a fast, any of the fast days during the year, but before we eat, we always give tzedakah. And what we tell our children, we try to remember this ourselves, is the way that we feel right before we break our fast, that's the way poor people feel all the time. They're very hungry. It's a terrible feeling. Hunger is a terrible, terrible feeling. And so at that time, when we're hungry, it's a good time to feel empathy for those who don't have and to give. The Jewish people here, they ran out of food. They weren't necessarily hungry yet, because they had just ran out of food, but they didn't know where the next meal was coming from. They were in the middle of the wilderness. There was no cultivated land. There was nothing. There were no cities. There were no settlements where they could buy food or barter for food or forage for food. There was nothing. They were in the middle of nowhere. And they had no place to go. It wasn't like they could just go home. Like, you know, you want to go camping. So you plan to go camping on a camping trip and you go for a week. after 2 days you don't like it, you get back in your car and drive home. Right? I don't like it here anymore. You go back. They didn't have that luxury. They were there and they had no place to go. They had no homeland. They had no city to go back to. Nothing. Couldn't go back to Egypt. So they had nothing. So the Jewish people having nothing and not seeing where the next meal is coming from, it was terrifying. And they reacted in a very intense way, with an intense complaint. Now, let's look carefully at the complaint, just to understand what they said. They said, I'm going back to Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, who would give our deaths at the hands of Hashem, at the hand of Hashem in Egypt? When did Jews die at the hand of Hashem in Egypt? Didn't Jews die at the hand of the Egyptians in Egypt? When did they die at the hand of Hashem in Egypt?
The ones that didn't make it.
Okay, so we know that many Jews died during the plague of darkness before they left. Here the Jews that survived and got out were saying, I don't get it. Why did you take us out so we should die here? We may as well just have died at the hands of Hashem in the plague of darkness. Because death by a plague, it may not be fun. No death is fun. And it may be painful. But it is not as bad as dying from starvation. Starvation is a terrible, terrible way. It's a terrible way to die. So they said, we'd rather have died at the hands of Hashem in Egypt. That would have been much better. Now, they say, when we sat on the pots of meat and we ate bread to satiation. The Medrash says over here, the Jews didn't eat meat in Egypt. Believe me, they didn't eat meat in Egypt. The Egyptians weren't interested in feeding the Jews meat. Mm-hmm. However, there was meat being cooked in Egypt. The Egyptians ate well. It was a very wealthy society, and they ate wealthy. They ate well. They didn't eat the animals that they worshipped, so they didn't eat cows and sheep and goats. But they did eat other types of meat that they were willing to eat. So,
like what?
Well,
rhinoceros.
He said rhinoceros.
Rhinoceros.
I don't know.
They have lions and tigers and bears.
They may be in fowl, right? Could be pigs. At any rate, but there was meat being cooked. Now, what does that have to do with anything? There was meat being cooked, and it says, and we ate our bread to satiation. So what does it mean? Who cares if there was meat being cooked if the Jews didn't get to eat it? So why do they even mention that?
There was abundance.
Okay. There was abundance in Egypt. That's the point. In Egypt, bread was cheap. They had meat. There was meat being cooked. There were barbecues all over the place. It wasn't a big deal. So there was abundance of food. When there's an abundance of food, then the slaves may have a lousy life, but they don't starve. When there's abundance of food, the slaves don't starve. The slaves may be beaten, the slaves may be overworked, the slaves may be exhausted, but they don't starve. There's what to eat because there's so much food. So the slaves aren't going to starve. So at least we ate. Yeah.
Could the reference be to the Paschal Lamb? Could that be a reference?
That's a good question. The reason why it can't be is because that was roasted over an open fire. There was no pot.
Not cooked.
And here it says specifically on the pots of meat. But that's very good. The Jews did eat meat before they left Egypt, but it was not in a pot. It was roasted meat over fire. So the fact, though, was that there was a lot of food in Egypt, and therefore the Jews ate to satiation. Now, the Medrash says they ate matzah. We say it at the Haggadah. We say, Halach ma'an yadya chalav asan abayar de Mitzrayim. We hold up the matzah. After we break it, we hold it and we say, this is the poor bread that our ancestors ate in Egypt. And they ate matzah. They didn't eat nice, fluffy bread. They didn't eat, you know, it wasn't a good sweet or
cake-like.
Right, it wasn't like that. It was a matzah-like bread. But they had enough. They were able to eat. That's the point they're making over here. We were able to eat. We didn't starve.
The Egyptians wouldn't starve. They needed them to work.
To work. So that's right. It was not in their interest to starve the Jewish people. That was not valuable to them. So why did you take us out to this wilderness to die here? What would be the point of that? Okay. So I'm not trying to make it that the complaint was perfect. It was not perfect. They did not complain in a humble way. But I am trying to show that we do need to understand in context how the complaint is going over here. They are out of food. They have no idea where it's going to come from. Hashem has never given them food before. They don't know for a fact that Hashem is going to, and they're afraid for starvation. So now comes the man. So the man is actually a fascinating study, and we're going to spend some time on it. We're only going to read a few more psukim, a few more verses tonight, and we're going to discuss them, and then there'll be several more. There's a bunch more to talk about, which will go on in subsequent classes. But tonight, we will do a few more verses, and we will show the man is not just another miracle. It's not just a sidebar in what went on in the wilderness. It really is a significant aspect of the Jewish experience, and the truth is, of the experience of humanity. Even though it is we who ate it, we Jews, and not the rest of the world, but for the experience of humanity, the man was really a very, very significant thing.
Do we know what man was?
Well, we're going to describe it as best we can. We don't know exactly, but we're going to describe as best we can. The Torah does give a few descriptions. So the Pasuk says, verse 4, Pasuk Dalet, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Hineni mamtir lachem lechem min ha-shamayim. I am going to bring down for you bread from the heavens. And the nation will go out and gather it each and every day, liman anasenu, so that I will test them. Hayelech besorasi imlo, will he or they, meaning the nation, go in my Torah or not? It's a funny thing. You would think Hashem is saying, I'm bringing bread from the sky so that you will have what to eat. You complained, you have nothing to eat. So I'm going to bring you bread to eat from the sky. But somebody says, I'm going to bring you bread from the sky in order that I will test you to see whether you follow my Torah or not. So that already should give us some pause about the man. The man is a test. The man is an examination to see whether we follow the Torah or not. The man is not fun and games. And it will be on the sixth day, and they will prepare that which they bring. It will be double on what they gather each and every other day. So on Friday, they will gather double mun, because we know it has to last for Shabbos as well. Let's stop there. Yes?
Sorry. The Jews at this point had not accepted the Torah yet.
Mm-hmm.
So why is Hashem already, more or less, testing them on Torah laws, really accepted the
okay.
Torah?
They had not gotten the Torah yet. Now remember, right. They did get some laws in Mara.
Right.
They had Shabbos.
Right.
They had, right? But you're 100% right. The mun is actually a prelude to Torah. The Gemara says, Lo nitna Torah, the Torah was not given, Ella la ochlei haman, only to those who ate man. You had to be eating man to receive the Torah. That's a funny statement. You had to be eating man to receive the Torah. Is there something wrong with other foods that if it's in your system, you're somehow impure and you can't receive the Torah? It may be true that the man is the purest food around. We'll talk about that a little bit. But it's deeper than that. The man was testing and prepping the Jews for the acceptance of the Torah. Because the man tests people whether you're going to listen to God or not. Because the man comes from the heavens, and we're going to see how it tests them. Now, these first two psukim about the man, they focus primarily on one aspect of it. There were several aspects of the man, but it focuses primarily on one of them, and that is the gathering of the man. As you see in Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, it says the nation will go out and gather day in and day out. Verse 5, on the sixth day, they will prepare what they bring, and it will be double what they gather each and every other day. There's something about gathering the man.
Shabbos.
It's not just the mun comes down from heaven and you open your mouth and it just falls right into your mouth. You have to gather it. Hashem could have made it that you walk outside like rain, just open your mouth and it'll just fall right in your mouth. It could have been that way, right? Hashem could have caused the mun to float down to the ground and just and then make a left turn and end up in your tent on your table. He could have done that too, right? He could have done anything he wanted. Once it's falling from the heavens, what difference does it make anymore? I mean, can you believe anything at that point? But there is a gathering process as well. It's not just the mun falls; it has to be gathered.
Does that go back to Adam when you have to work for your food?
Well, they didn't have to work, but they did have to get.
They had to do something.
Okay, they had to do something. This is. Let's start there. This is without question a somewhat of a reversal of that curse, the curse of Adam, where you need to work hard by the sweat of your brow. You will eat bread. Here, they did not need to plant or plow or harvest or winnow or thresh or anything. They didn't do any of this stuff. They didn't even have to grind or knead or bake. It was fully ready to eat bread that came from the heavens. Mun was completely ready to eat when it landed. You could pop it right in your mouth. So it's certainly a reversal to a certain extent, but you are correct. There still is the gathering. That there still is. Yes?
So the word here is lechem. Where do we see the word mun? We're talking about mun.
Good.
Where is the word
good.
Mun?
So the word mun is going to come later. It hasn't happened yet. Hashem hasn't said it yet. The Jews are going to name it mun. The Jews will name it mun. We'll see later why they name it mun.
But here they're talking about lechem.
Yes.
The Jews are going to call it mun.
Yes, we'll see that later. That will come up later on. The mun, as I said, is a significant experience for all of humanity. We Jews ate the mun, and we ate it for 40 years, for 39 years in the wilderness. No, almost 40 years. We ate it for 40. It says we ate it for 40 years. We ate it for 40 years in the wilderness. The mun fell, and it landed in various places around the Jewish camp, and the Jews collected it and ate it. The Torah is going to tell us later that the leftover mun, what happened to it? The mun that wasn't collected.
Spoiled.
What's that?
Spoiled.
Jews who collected mun and left it over till the next day, it spoiled. But what about the mun that sat out there in the field and was never collected? So it says that the sun rose and it melted. And the Medrash says when it melted, it seeped into the streams, and it was consumed by various animals, like deer. And then non-Jews who hunted those deer, when they slaughtered the deer and ate of the meat, they would taste some residue of that of the mun. And so even those who were not Jewish got a sampling of what mun is. And they knew from what they ate that there's obviously a food that the Jews are eating that is literally heavenly. A heavenly food that the Jews are eating. So it became an experience that, although obviously it's our experience, but it was also, it carried over a little bit to the rest of the world. In the beginning of creation, in Bereishis, the mun is already alluded to. And this is what I'm talking about, how the mun is a central factor. It's not just another miracle. All the way back, for those of you who were with us 6.5 years ago when we started this class, you might recall. Let's hold the place here and go back. Now, you'll be familiar with these verses. Go back to page 10, please. That's going back. This is the seventh day of creation, which is Shabbos, of course. And the first three verses here in chapter 2 are the ones that we say Friday night about Shabbos. Vayichulu Hashemayim v'haaretz v'chol tzva'am, and the heavens and earth were completed and all of their hosts. Vayichal Elokim b'yom ha'ashvi'i melachto asher asah, God finished on the seventh day the work that he did. Vayishbos b'yom ha'ashvi'i, he rested on the seventh day mikol melachto asher asah, from all of the work that he did. Now here's the crucial one. Vayivarech Elokim es yom ha'ashvi'i, and God blessed the seventh day. Now there's no Jewish people yet. I mean, Adam is created, but God blessed the seventh day, vayikadesho so, and he sanctified it. So God didn't just make a seventh day. He didn't just finish his work. He didn't just rest, but he blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified the seventh day. Kivo shavas mikol melachto, for then he withdrew from all of his work, Ashabra Elokim Ma'asas, that God had created to do. So God blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified the seventh day. The Medrash tells us, what does that mean, he blessed it and he sanctified it? How did he bless the day? How did he sanctify the day? The Medrash says, Berachol b'man, v'kidsho b'man. God blessed it with man, and he sanctified it with man. He blessed it with man, that the man that was left over from Friday, he blessed it with man, that a double portion of man fell on Friday. That because Shabbos was coming up, therefore the seventh day got a double portion of man. He blessed the seventh day in that there would be a double portion on Friday. And he sanctified the seventh day that no man fell on the seventh day. Yes?
But previously you said the man wouldn't last another day.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're saying for 2 days.
From Friday to Shabbos it would last. That's what Torah's going to tell us explicitly. Yes. We'll see that. That was the one exception. On Friday, you would get a double portion, and it would not rot. It would last and be just as good, just as fresh the next day. So already in the days of creation, the man is alluded to. God blesses the seventh day, and he also sanctifies the seventh day. And he does it in the same manner. The blessing is that there's a double portion of man on the sixth day. That's not a blessing of the sixth day. That's a blessing of the seventh day. Because the seventh day's portion falls on the sixth day. And there is a sanctification of the seventh day in that no man falls on the seventh day. The seventh day, the shop is closed. Nothing comes down on the seventh day. The man is a significant test. What is the great test of man? To see whether the Jews will follow my rules or not. What is the great test of the man?
Emunah.
Emunah is belief in God. Now, how is it a test of emunah, faith?
You're hungry and you finally see something and you're afraid that if you don't grab everything that there's not going to be enough.
Okay. So the man was was solving a problem. The Jews had nothing to eat. Now there's going to be something to eat. That's not really true. What I just said is not really true. It didn't really solve a problem. If the Jews were starving and God gave them man, then the man would be solving a problem. Right? They're starving. They have food. Now they're not starving anymore. That would solve the problem. But the Jews weren't starving. When the Jews were thirsty, they didn't have water for 3 days, and God gave them water, that solved a problem. Here, the problem wasn't we're starving. That wasn't the problem. The problem was, there's no food. We will starve. We don't have any food left. And there's no place to get food from. And therefore, we're scared for the future because there's no food. And when people don't know where the next meal is coming from, they're scared. The man did not solve that problem because all the man did was perpetuate the problem. It allowed the Jews to survive with the problem. See, normally, if a person has a problem that there's no food to eat, The person is not hungry because they just ate. They just had the last bit of food that there is to eat. It's the middle of the winter. They're in. What's the long winter? The Little House on the Prairie. It's the middle of the. I love those books. It's the middle of whatever is South Dakota, and there's nothing. It's snowbound. There's nothing. They use up the last bit of wheat. There's nothing to eat, and there's no place to get it from. They're not hungry because they just ate. They just had a meal. They're not hungry, but there's no food. That is terrifying, as we mentioned. Most of the time, that problem can't last that long because that problem quickly changes to another problem because then it turns into hunger. See, the first problem is not hunger. The first problem is fear. Where's the next food going to come from? I'm not hungry yet. I'm full. But I don't know where the next meal is going to come from. That's a problem. But if that goes on for the next 12 hours or 24 hours, now that's another problem. I'm hungry.
But
I'm not just afraid. I'm hungry. The Jews were afraid. They weren't hungry. And Hashem said to them, okay, I'm going to make sure that you're able to remain afraid but not hungry. I'm going to give you food every day and you're going to eat it. But there's going to be nothing left at the end of the day. There will be nothing left. There will be no refrigerator. There will be no pantry. There will be no stores. There will be no crops. There will be no sellers of food. Nothing. Zero. You're going to eat it up. Your kids are going to eat it up. And you will not have anything to give them for breakfast in the morning. When you go to sleep at night, you'll be full, but you will have nothing. Nothing. So I'm going to perpetuate that state of being of, where is the next meal going to come from? And the only answer you're going to have is me. That's the only answer you're going to have. You're going to have to go to sleep every night with the firm belief that the next morning, bread is going to fall from the sky. That's it. And that is going to be the Jewish existence for the next 40 years. It's an amazing thing. It's something that no people has ever gone through before. It's never happened. In the physical world, it's almost impossible to conceive of such a situation because it usually turns into one of two things. Either it turns into real hunger or it turns into food in the fridge, or, you know, an abundance of food that's available for the next few days. But that there should be nothing left every single night when you go to sleep, it doesn't happen. Hashem says, that's the existence I want you Jews to have. And I want you to do it for an extended period of time. Because I am training you. I am training you to trust in me.
Yeah. I can understand if they felt that fear for the first, say, week, or 4 weeks, whatever. But if every day it comes from the heaven, wouldn't you think they would get used to it?
When they get used to it. So you obviously could get used to it. However, there were enough miracles that happen with the mun that we have to talk a little bit about the various types. We have a few more minutes left. We'll try to get explained. You're right. After a little while, you're going to start to think it's some sort of an entitlement that the mun just falls from the sky. Right. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit. Okay, so it's true that the next generation is going to be different.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're also going to have mun, and we'll talk about that. We'll see. It goes on for 40 years. So here, let's just make a couple. We just have a few more minutes. Let's just make a couple of points over here before we run out of time. The mun did have some differences for each person. The mun, first of all, had different consistencies. It had the best consistency for the most righteous, and the worst consistency for the least righteous. Righteous. That's number one. Number two is that the mun fell, as the Medrash tells us, closer or further to your home, depending on a person's level of righteousness. So that if a person was acting properly, the mun fell in a place where it was easy for him to collect it. But if that day the person, maybe they said something that wasn't so nice, or they didn't daven properly, or they didn't learn whatever, something, they didn't do something too right. They would wake up the next morning and they had to go trek a mile to go find the mun. It was a, it was a, it, 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 there was a, there was an immediate sense of a person standing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with Hashem, with the man. So it's true, you knew the man was going to fall, at least you hoped the man was going to fall, but if a person didn't act properly, it was not as simple as a person did. We'll see more about that as we go along. But I want to make one other observation about this. The mun, therefore, is the thing that sends the message home that parnasa, that a person's livelihood, is from Hashem. Hashem is the one who provides livelihood. The mun was obvious. Bread falling from the sky. The opposite of what normally happens. It didn't come from the ground. It came from the sky. So what was the bracha on the mud, by the way? Hamotzi lechem min hashamayim. The one who brings bread forth from the heavens, not from the earth. It came from upstairs. So the mun is that food that sends the message home very clearly that livelihood comes from Hashem. Now, we all know this. We all know it. We all know the livelihood comes from Hashem. We all daven to Hashem for our livelihood. And we all recognize that when we get a paycheck or we make money or whatever it is, it's coming from Hashem. We understand that. We don't think about it all the time, and we do work for a living, so when we work, we are putting an effort, and we get paid for what we do. But we recognize that it's ultimately Hashem is in control, not us. There's a rule in the Torah. There's a rule in the Torah, and that rule is Shabbos. And we know on Shabbos that there's a lot of things that we're not allowed to do, and certain things that we're supposed to do. One of the things that we know we're not supposed to do on Shabbos is work. Now, the truth is, when it says not to work in the Torah, it doesn't mean work as in make money. It means to do the Lamed Hes Melach, to do the 39 creative acts. Okay, but we know a Jew doesn't go to work on Shabbos. We know you're not supposed to do that. Now, a person, why would a person go to work on Shabbos? Why would they do it?
Doctor?
Well, doctor's different. He's talking about life and death situation. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
That's saving somebody's life.
Yeah.
Different situation. But I'm talking about going to work. So why would a person go to work on Shabbos?
To make money.
To make money, right? Now, if a person knows that I don't need to work, that the same exact deals that they would be available to them on Shabbos will be available on Monday, then why would they work on Shabbos? No one's going to work on Shabbos if they believe that working on Shabbos is not going to get me any more than if I wouldn't work on Shabbos. If I knew for a fact that any business deal that I can close on Shabbos, I'd be able to close on Friday or on Monday or on Tuesday, then of course, why shouldn't I take a day off? Why would I work more than I have to? I'll take a day off. Right? Forget the laws of Shabbos. Why should I work more than I need to? I'll work on Monday. But when people work on Shabbos because they believe that there's a certain amount of money to be made on Shabbos that they won't get if they don't work on Shabbos. Back in the early part of the 20th century, where most Jews who came to America worked on Shabbos, because they believed there was no way to make money without working on Shabbos. It was virtually impossible, and therefore they worked on Shabbos. It's not because they said, "Well, forget it, I don't care, I'm just going to work on Shabbos." It's because they felt there was no other way to get money. So Hashem is using the mun to bring this point home. Hashem is saying, look, the mun comes from me. But even when the mun comes from me, it doesn't fall on Shabbos. It doesn't fall on Shabbos. And in fact, there's double on Friday. Hashem is saying, I want you to understand something. No Jew is going to lose money because they didn't work on Shabbos. That's the message Hashem is sending with the mun. You're not going to lose, I shouldn't say you're not going to lose money. You may not be, it could be that you won't become a millionaire. But no Jew is going to lose livelihood. No Jew is going to starve because they didn't work on Shabbos. Whatever you would have gotten for working on Shabbos, you'll get without working on Shabbos. I'm talking about in terms of starvation, in terms of having enough to live on. In terms of getting rich, Hashem decides who gets rich, who doesn't, that's a different story. But in terms of what will a person have, will they be able to put bread on the table? Will they be able to put clothes on their back? Will they be able to put a roof over their head or not? Shabbos is not going to make or break it. Working on Shabbos is not going to change the situation. And the mun is the vehicle through which Hashem shows that to the people. The mun which hits that message home of that it all comes from Hashem, all the way in the beginning when God created the world, the very first Shabbos, He blessed it with mun and He sanctified it with mun. That Shabbos is not a day which you need to work. Not if you're a Jew. If you're not a Jew, it's different because then you don't get the blessing of Shabbos. But if you're a Jew, Shabbos is not going to make or break it. Yeah?
What you said about working on Shabbos, because I know from personal stories that I've heard that a lot of these people who came over from Europe to work to the United States, if they didn't work on Shabbos, they didn't have a job.
Right. They lost their job.
They hired somebody who would work on
Right.
Shabbos.
So, we can't judge. We weren't there. We can't judge them. It was a very, very. It was a terrifying situation, because
right.
you lost your job and you didn't know where the next job was coming from, and it was, and there was no safety net. They didn't have any kind of social, there was no. There was nothing. There was no one to take care of them. If you didn't, right? So it was a terrifying situation, and we can't judge them. And it was the vast majority of Jews who came over. Very, very few people survived that particular test. There's no question that was a very, very difficult time for us Jews with Shabbos, and Hashem solved that problem for us with the secular world changing. The whole way that people go to work changed, and you don't have to work on Shabbos anymore, right? But that was not the case in the beginning of the 20th century, and that was a very, 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 very difficult test.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.